Thanks for joining us for Episode 5 of our special series, Democracy Optimists, with Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law. Democracy Optimist is produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU.
What does it mean? To be American.
Throughout the 2024 election season, we're bringing you conversations with election and voting experts from all across the political spectrum, so that when you go to the polls on November 5th, you'll get there fully informed about how it all works. Here's Josh Douglas.
Today, we are talking about the power of a nonprofit advocacy organization with a storied history to fight for significant changes to how we run our elections. The League of Women Voters started as part of the push for women's suffrage and has grown to a major nationwide organization with chapters all over the country. The League of Women Voters of Kentucky has been part of the debates on the state's voter ID law, redistricting battles, and efforts to improve transparency within Kentucky's government. I'm delighted to welcome Jennifer Jackson, Becky Jones, and Laura Weinstein to Democracy Optimist. Thank you all for joining us. Jen, I'll start with you. You're now the president of the League of Women Voters of Kentucky. Tell us about that role.
You know, absolutely. Thanks so much. I love the introduction about the League being around for the last 103 years, coming up on our 104th anniversary. And I always try to emphasize, even in the very beginning, that while the League is a nonpartisan organization, we are a political organization, but we don't support particular candidates or political parties. And so my role as the president is really of this grassroots organization is to make sure that we are laser focused on our mission, which is making avenues for citizens to engage in our government, and then also making sure that voters are educated and able to make informed decisions when they go to vote. And a lot of that is just really like helping people keep up with the different voting laws and how to participate. So there are a lot of things happening now with the League. We are in a period of transformation. For any organization that's been around for over 100 years, there's bound to be some changes. And so as a national organization, we realize that we are really in a period of moving to more modern ways of interacting with people. And you'll see some of that in a lot of the things that we are doing with the State League and engaging with newer technology. I know that the League is kind of known as the old ladies with clipboards, but we've got some new tools in our pockets. And so we're rolling out different mechanisms to be able to reach voters and for letting people to get involved. So, you know, text banks, we have an app, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But there's a lot of like new ways that people can have people can get involved and not have to dedicate their let's have to be a full-time job like volunteering with the League. And so, you know, in the past, like 40 years ago or so when women weren't necessarily, or 50 years ago when women weren't in the workspace, they had more time to volunteer and things. And so we're seeing demographic shifting. And so we really want to get back to allowing those opportunities for younger people to get involved with the League and busy people who are busy with work and kids in ways that they can get involved even while they're just waiting in line at the grocery store.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, to emphasize that it's not just an organization of old women, you know, it's of all age ranges and all genders. I'm a member of the League as well. Because of the importance of the work that the League does. So, Jen, you actually started a collegiate chapter of the League when you were in college. So tell us a little bit about that. And I think more broadly, how do we engage young voters in particular? And what efforts are you all making to engage young voters?
Yeah, so I started, me and my friend Amanda Tatro, we started a chapter of the League of Women Voters at Kentucky. This was a while ago. So, and I have to say that, you know, we went through this whole process of creating bylaws and trying to recruit members and stuff. And And I will say that it was a raging success because we really struggled to get members, and it was before the age of really the internet and social media and all of those things. And so, you know, we're like tacking up our flyers on the bulletin board. But it did provide a foundation for me to understand like what the League of Women Voters does. And so having those women that were involved with the organization or other people that were involved with the organization at that time, I met them, learned about the things that they were doing. And so, you know, later on, you know, I got busy with life, my career training and things, but there became an opportunity for me to, that I had more free time on my hands and I wanted to get involved. The first organization that came to mind was the League of Women Voters. And of course, that was because of that experience that I had had in college. And the women that I remember who were in leadership at that time, they really encouraged me to explore this avenue of creating this chapter at UK and, you know, empowered me to really dig into that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really love about the League is that we do provide opportunities for people to really dig into the thing that they're passionate about.
And of course, we hope that it's democracy, you know, listening to this show. Laura, you are the chair of the Kentucky League's Voter Services Committee. Obviously, it's the League of Women Voters, and you're the chair of the committee that's kind of focused on engaging voters. What is the role of that committee, and what specific tangible things do you all do to try to engage voters?
Sure. Yes. And thank you so much for having us on the show. This is a real treat. So the Voter Services Committee really tries to coordinate the League of Women Voters voter outreach efforts across the state. So each individual league has a Voter Services Committee and does the work. But we try to get together to talk about best practices and also creating materials for voter engagement, including print materials. We also have reminders through the League in Action app that Jen was referencing. But it's really an opportunity to determine what is the best way to not only register voters but across the state, but also to get out the vote across the state. So for the last election cycle, it was really exciting. We used our League in Action app to register voters through text banking and then through friend banking to encourage them to register. And then we also had a get out the vote text banking through our League in Action app. So again, as Jen mentioned, we're trying to use more technology to engage and get out the word to more people rather than just trying to table through clipboards, because we know that technology is a way to really be innovative in this space and to get more voters engaged. So we're so excited about this. And actually, the League is a leader in utilizing this technology across the country. So I had the honor of going to the League Council meeting in Las Vegas, and many other states are not using this technology. And I think it's really exciting. And I think there's so much opportunity here with us, especially with voter engagement.
So you mentioned friend banking. I understand text banking. Tell us a little bit about friend banking.
Yeah. So friend banking is a great way to use relational coordinating to get out messaging. So instead of texting somebody that you don't know, you can actually use our app to contact people that are in your phone. So I can reach out to maybe 20 of my friends to take an action to register to vote or to do something in regards to voter engagement. So it's a great way to really connect with the people you already know that may take an action that may not know about an upcoming voter registration deadline. So it's a really valuable tool. And often I get the best feedback from my friends who are very excited to hear about something they didn't know about.
That's great. And so can individuals download this app and use it themselves?
Yes, we encourage you to. Yes.
How would we find it?
I'll just defer to Jen on this question. She may know the best way for someone to download it.
Yeah, sure. So you can get it wherever you get your app. So on the Apple Store for iPhones and at the Play Store, it's called League in Action. You'll have to set up an account because it wants to send you your specific information. But then you can follow you just search for Kentucky, and it'll bring up all the leagues that have a League in Action account in Kentucky. You can follow the League of Women Voters of Kentucky, or, you know, Lexington has one too. I'm based in Lexington, so I'm partial to that. And there'll be different content. So obviously at the state level, we deal more with, like right now we're getting a lot of action alerts for things that are going on in the legislature. We will have voting information on all on both of those platforms, but be sure to accept the notifications, because that's how we app notifications, because that's how we send out the reminders for all the deadlines of when you have to be registered, apply for your absentee ballot, all of those different things. So you don't want to miss out on that capability too.
Great, great information. Becky Jones, you are the first vice president of the League of Women Voters of Kentucky. What do you wish the public knew about the League, and perhaps what are kind of the misconceptions people might have that you can correct?
Well, I think we've mentioned a lot of them, and thank you for inviting us. I feel humbled and grateful to be in the company of these great women who are with me today, and you as well. So thanks for inviting us. We've mentioned before, but it bears repeating, that you don't have to be a woman to be a member of the League. That's key. Jen mentioned also that we are nonpartisan. We're a grassroots organization. Our primary goal is to protect and expand voting rights. And that's how we started, and we continue that work to this day. We do that by working to ensure that everyone is represented in our democracy. And we have determined that we're going to defend that democracy through our advocacy efforts. We work a lot now with in the General Assembly, keep trying to stay on top of bills, then educating the public, so education. And then when necessary, we use litigation at the state, local state, or national level. So those are the things that I really wish people would understand and take away about what League of Women Voters is all about.
Mm-hmm. Now, Becky, you mentioned how the League is nonpartisan. Jen mentioned that as well. But if you look at many of the laws that the League has championed in recent years, a skeptic might say, it sounds like you're for the Democratic Party, because many of the things that you all have advocated for in terms of expanding voting rights are also things that have been Democratic Party priorities. So what's your response to that in terms of how you stay nonpartisan when it, you know, an observer might think you're a pretty liberal group?
Well, as Jen said, we don't support political parties. We don't support candidates. Now, if the issues that we support and take a position on tend to be more progressive, I think that that is a reflection of our commitment to making sure that our democracy represents everyone. And if progressive means bringing people into the system and ensuring that they're welcomed and their rights are protected, then I don't find that's a knock. I think that's a great thing, because if you're not progressing, you're moving backwards. And we cannot be in a position of moving backwards in this country.
Sure. Now, you mentioned, you know, supporting various initiatives or various issues. The League has a pretty involved process for even deciding whether you're going to support a particular issue. I know, for example, right now the League is thinking about its position, the Kentucky League, that is thinking about its position on open primaries. Tell us a little bit about just the process of deciding whether to endorse a particular policy proposal.
Correct. That's a great example. We are undertaking a study at the state level to look at the primary system in Kentucky, which is, as you know, closed primaries.
Meaning you have to be registered with a particular political party to participate. You have to
Correct.
Be registered as a Democrat or Republican, et cetera.
Yeah. And the reality is more and more people are choosing not to associate with any particular party, and they're registering as independent. And that excludes them from the very important work that happens in the primary system. In so many instances around our state, the candidate or the winning candidate is decided in the primary, because there just is no opposition come general election time. And so to disenfranchise people who are registered independent or with another third party from participating in primaries doesn't seem to be defending democracy and expanding voting rights for all people. So we're undertaking a study about whether or not open primaries would benefit all people in the state of Kentucky. We look at a lot of work that's been done across the country by other leagues and see the kind of studying and research that they've done, We take that down then to each local league, and we hold meetings and discussions, and we try to reach a consensus. We must reach a consensus on whether or not we would support open primaries or not support open primaries. So we will not take a position unless it's well researched.
Mm-hmm. Jen, if you had a magic wand and could pass one election rule for Kentucky, one change to Kentucky elections, what would it be?
Gosh, there's so many things.
I'm forcing you to choose one. So it makes this question hard.
To choose one. Now, I have to say, it is like my own personal... all right, it's kind of a toss-up. I would say maybe same-day voter registration, because so many people forget to register to vote.
Yeah, and Kentucky has a 29-day registration deadline. So for people who are not paying attention a month before the election, you're out of luck. Studies show that about the states that have same-day voter registration, it's at about two-thirds of them, have much higher turnout than the states that don't. So that's a good one. Laura, are you optimistic about voting in elections? Or, you know, there's so much doom and gloom out there. Do we need to embrace the doom and gloom instead?
Well, we talked about this the other day. I'm certainly trying to be optimistic. And I think there's a quote, a John Lewis quote, that says, democracy is not a state, it's an act. And so we have to act constantly. We can't be okay with the status quo. There's always room for improvement. There's always room for change. And so because maybe our systems are always subject to capture, we always have to be optimistic in that things can get better, and that we as people who work together in a collaborative space can come up with new ideas and opportunities for engaging people and making sure that everyone's voice is heard.
Yeah, and that reminds me of something that I often say, which is democracy is not a spectator sport. I'm sure I'm not the person that came up with that. I'm sure I heard it elsewhere. But that John Lewis quote, you know, similar, it's an act, is one I really like. This has been such a great conversation. I wish we had more time to dive into more issues that the league is engaged with. But really quickly, if people want to become engaged, the best way to do it is...
So you can either download our app, so that's League in Action, or just hop on our website, which is lwvky.org. There is a calendar there where you can see where we have upcoming committee meetings, but we also post a lot of different ways to get involved. We have various events throughout the year, but we really are, you know, as a grassroots organization, we really, it's about personal connections. And so a lot of people have been volunteers with the league for many years. We have people who have been legacy. In fact, Laura, her mom was a league member at some point.
Great.
But it's just a so the website lwvky.org, and that is your gateway to learning all about the league and the opportunities that are available.
Wonderful. Jennifer Jackson, Becky Jones, and Laura Weinstein of the League of Women Voters of Kentucky, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just Laura Weinstein mentioned that the League of Women Voters has this app that helps us stay up on events, on voting information, get legislative updates. Is this kind of technology something of a game changer for voter engagement?
It's crucial to engage the next generation of voters. I mean, you know, people are not going to events where they're clipboards as much anymore, like they said. You really need to think about new technologies and new ways, especially because, you know, we want the younger generation who doesn't vote as much to be engaged and to understand the importance of participating. So, yeah, I was really thrilled to hear about the app, about the text banking, and about ways they're thinking of embracing these technologies.
Well, as we do in each of these segments, I have a few questions for you. And one of them is, could you single out an election law? There are so many of them. What one election law should we be aware of?
Well, I'm going to look back to history on this one, because we talked about the League of Women Voters and its founding as part of the women's suffrage movement that culminated in the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So that's the one to be aware of, the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote in all elections nationwide. But you might not know that women were voting in many places in many elections, especially in the West, well before the 19th Amendment was ratified. Wyoming, which was a territory at the time, not a state, passed the first women's suffrage law on December 10th, 1869, and women voted for the first time there in 1870. But in fact, women could vote even earlier than that in New Jersey in 1797. New Jersey passed a law that recognized the right of women to vote across the state, and women did vote in large numbers. The state then repealed that law in 1807. And one of the things I think is really interesting about the story of the 19th Amendment is that it's one of local advocacy. In communities and states all over the country, you had these places that were enfranchising women, sometimes just for local elections or school board elections, and that kind of snowballed into a larger movement as, you know, states passed women's suffrage laws in the late 1800s and the 1890s and the early 1900s. I think it just goes to show that a nationwide movement for voting reform and voting expansion often starts at the grassroots level. And that's an important lesson for today's discussions on expanding the right to vote.
Well, I'm really glad I asked that question. I did not know that history of suffrage. Really interesting. So just for the fun of it, give us a fun election fact.
Well, let's continue to talk about the League of Women Voters because it's been such an important organization in the fight for democracy reform. It was founded as a successor to the National American Women's Suffrage Association, which had led the nationwide fight for women's suffrage. That organization was made up of a merger between the American Women's Suffrage Association and the National Women's Suffrage Association, so two groups that were kind of fighting for women's rights and women's suffrage. The two groups kind of were competing, however. The American Women's Suffrage group was kind of high class and chose to take a submissive activist role, while the National Women's Suffrage Association used kind of confrontational tactics. For example, Susan B. Anthony, who was part of the National Women's Suffrage group, was arrested in 1872 for trying to vote. And then the other organization that was kind of big in this time period was the Women's Christian Temperance Union. It was the largest women's organization in the U.S. at the time. It gave women's suffrage a major boost by endorsing it. And the argument from that group was that women needed to vote to protect their families from vices, specifically alcohol, right? So it was all part of this prohibition discussion as well. Eventually, the groups all joined efforts with one goal in mind, securing women the right to vote. And after the 19th Amendment was ratified in August of 1920, the League of Women Voters was formed to, quote, finish the fight and aid in the reconstruction of the nation.
Well, Jen Jackson with the League of Women Voters pointed out that the League is all about helping us sort out how we can be involved in elections and voting. So what's Josh Douglas's one thing we can do to support democracy?
So people are often surprised when I tell them that I'm a member of the League of Women Voters because I'm not a woman. And so I think it's important to recognize that the League really does welcome anyone who cares about democracy. So the one thing I would say is look up your local league and figure out an event that you might want to go to. They do a lot of events on Zoom, in fact, or some other virtual way, which makes it really convenient to do it from the comfort of your own home. So take a look at the local League of Women Voters for where you live and see if there's an event that you might want to attend.
And I think it's important to emphasize that this is a nonpartisan organization. It's all about voting.
Right? Yeah, and it's all about the issues, right? So, you know, I asked them, doesn't it sound like you're a liberal group because you support what sounds like liberal initiatives? And their response was really telling, which was, no, we support voters. And, you know, it's, I think, a little bit troubling if we start thinking that supporting expanded access for everyone means that you're in the bag for one political party or the other. You're trying to promote democracy. I always think back to the Declaration of Independence, right? One of the things it says is that a government is legitimate based on the consent of the governed. Shouldn't the governed include all of us giving that consent?
Coming up in a moment,
the easier it is for voters to engage and let their voices be heard, the higher trust they're going to have in the process, the higher trust they're going to have in the government that represents them. And so I think it's absolutely crucial that we ensure all voters can access the process.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor Josh Douglas.
Today, we are delighted to speak with Amber McReynolds, who is the vice chair of the United States Postal Service Board of Governors, which is a Senate-confirmed position, where she focuses on the Postal Service's processing of mail-in ballots. Basically, she's the person who guarantees that millions of ballots are processed correctly through the mails. Amber, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So, wow, millions of ballots going through the mails. That's got to be a logistical nightmare from, you know, all the states having to get both to the voters and then back to the election officials, especially because some states conduct their elections entirely via the mail. What's the biggest challenge?
Well, first and foremost, I, as you mentioned, I'm the vice chair of the Board of Governors. So that's the oversight aspect of the Postal Service, just like a Fortune 50 board of directors. I have a board role. I chair the Election Mail Committee. But the management team and the team is really who handles all of the aspects of election mail going through the Postal Service. And we've done a couple of things actually since 2020. So first at the governor level, which is I'm one of the governors, we've established a permanent election mail and government mail committee that takes a look at these all of these issues surrounding election and government mail and monitors that. Then we've also, the management team actually internally restructured the election mail team to add more resources, add more oversight, add more accountability, all within the realm of election and government mail. And that's really important and key to making sure communication is streamlined to our massive operation nationwide. And a couple things about the Postal Service. So first, we have about 640,000 employees. We have over 32,000 locations. We're the only entity, business, government, any, that serve every single constituent, citizen, household, business, as well as every voter, as well as every election office, almost every day of the year. So it's a massive operation, to say the least. And we have a touch point in every community in the United States of America. So that's why, you know, not only for mail ballots, as you mentioned, but all election material, polling place assignment cards, voter registration letters, election materials broadly, all of that goes through the postal system to reach voters. So there's a huge impact, a huge process that happens. Just to give you a sense of the numbers, on a daily basis, we deliver over 400 million pieces of mail a day to 173 million doors. So the capacity is massive. The ability of the Postal Service is massive. Our carriers are on the front lines delivering to all those doors every day. And we take this seriously. And that's, you know, that's why I think it's an important highlight that you're doing here in terms of the work that goes into putting on a big election.
That's really amazing. It's sort of mind-boggling to think about the number of pieces of mail that have to make it through the system to have a successful election. Walk us through the actual process of a ballot within the Postal Service. You know, so I request for my county clerk that I want to vote absentee, some states call it. Some states, you know, just mail-in ballot. I request that. What happens next from your all's process?
Well, so first and foremost, I mean, the Postal Service, just like every piece of mail we deliver mail that's brought to us. And those policies are determined at the state level, at each state level. And then the federal government obviously has roles when it comes to what mailings go out. Help America Vote Act, MVRA, a number of federal laws have dictated what happens. So we're not involved in the policy making process around that. We accept mail from jurisdictions that are utilizing our services to support the election process. So states that are, for instance, they mail a ballot proactively to everyone, they have various security measures ahead of that mailing that determine, for instance, check a change of address. They might have automatic or automated voter registration to make sure the addresses are most up to date. States like Colorado have that process in place and have for a long time. And then the other states that where you're required to request a mail ballot, you have to sign up for that either before each election, each year, or on a permanent basis like what Arizona has. But in that instance, you're interacting with the election official, telling them where to send your requested mail-in ballot. The election officials are validating that you're a registered voter, that you're active, meaning you haven't moved or your address has not changed. They're also checking to make sure that the voter is, like I said, an eligible voter. So if a voter, for instance, that pre-registered to vote at 16 signed up for a mail ballot, they're not 18 yet, they might not be eligible to get that if they did request it. There's all these eligibility checks that go into the process on the election official side of things, and that varies by state, varies by jurisdiction. It depends on what the state laws are in that place. And then election officials go through a period of time where they certify the ballot content about 60 days out, usually from every election day. And that's where they're determining what that ballot will look like, what information will appear on that ballot for the voter. And then they go into a process of preparing that for printing, proofing it, preparing it for printing. They usually, a lot of election offices do that in-house where they'll print and mail everything manually. A lot of the larger jurisdictions in some states, they use a vendor to help them print all of that material. And those vendors are certified either at the state level or in conjunction with a professional process. And then the election officials will send a file of either requested ballots, people that have signed up to request it, if that's what their state law is, or in a state where it's proactive, they'll send that list of eligible voters that are set to receive and be mailed their ballot. The printer prepares all that material. A lot of states now are using intelligent mail barcode tracking, which provides accountability through the entire process. They'll spray that barcode information on the outside of the envelope. All of that printing and processing happens, and the ballots are then prepared for mailing. And then after all of that, they get dropped with the Postal Service, usually in some sort of pre-sort method to leverage the best practices and also the best rates for mailing. And then it comes to us, and we scan it through our various processing facilities. We're scanning that intelligent mail barcode as that's been sprayed on there so that voters can see where their mail ballot is at every step in the process. And then our carriers get it, and it gets delivered out to the house. And then the reverse of that happens if the voter chooses for the ballot to be mailed back to us. And I will say states vary on this note too, as you can imagine. Some states pay pre-postage, and they handle that on their end. Other states, the voter has to affix postage. And so it just depends on what a state chooses to do in terms of policy on that.
Yeah. What happens if you're in a state that requires the voter to put the postage on and the person delivers their ballot without a stamp?
So the policy and the process has been, and we work, as I said, we've got a whole team of people that work directly with election officials around the country to work out with them what their processes are around these issues. But when a voter doesn't affix the proper postage, that actually gets billed to the election office. So the ballot will still get delivered back to the election official, but the election official will pick up essentially the and cover the remainder of the postage that's not affixed on there. So, you know, for voters, it's far easier if the postage is prepaid, just so they don't have to, you know, worry about that. But most states still require the voter to affix postage. And usually that will appear in the instruction sheet that the voter receives in the mail.
But, you know, just dispelling one myth that I hear from people, the ballot will still get delivered, even though you should put postage on. That's the state requirement. You know, votes are not going uncounted because of that. So here's the big question. You answered this a little bit already, I think, but just to dive kind of directly at it. The big question many people have and the resistance to more widespread vote by mail policies, this is concern about fraud. So can you address why fraud is not a major concern, even with millions of ballots being processed via the Postal Service?
Yeah, well, so first, it's really about a lot of the checks and balances that happen before the ballots are ever mailed. And, you know, with a process of, you know, in essence, when we are when election officials, and I say we because I'm part of this community or was, when a ballot is mailed out, it has already gone through various checks and balances that actually don't happen when it don't always happen in the same way with regards to in-person voting. And what I mean by that is for a ballot to get to the voter at the correct address and for them to be able to vote that ballot, we have to know, the election officials have to know where that voter is. They have to have the correct address on file. They have to have that correct information. They're determining eligibility before that ballot is ever mailed out. So if you're inactive or you haven't updated your address in a while or you haven't engaged with the election office, you're not going to be able to get that in the mail until you actually take action, until you contact your election official. So they're only going out to active voters, first and foremost. They're only going out, and this is after various checks and balances happen, but automated things like national change of address check or checks against motor vehicle database, especially in states that leverage the ERIC system, which is a cross-state check of when voters move around the country. All of that is happening before that ballot packet is ever mailed to voters. And I think that's an important piece that often gets overlooked. You sort of hear politicians say, oh, they're just being mailed out. And actually, that's not the case. There's a lot of steps that go in to play before that ballot is ever put in the mail stream. Postal Service is delivering what it's, you know, what we are given, just like all the other mail that we are, that people pay us to deliver. We don't necessarily have anything to do with that check that election officials go through. And the other thing I would say is ballots are not forwardable. So like a lot of pieces of mail can be forwarded to a new address if the voter moves, ballots cannot be forwarded. So if that voter is no longer at that address, that ballot will actually come back to the election official and the voter has to take action to tell the election official where their new address is before that ballot is mailed out.
I feel like every year we hear these anecdotes of, you know, oh, I received a ballot from, you know, someone who lived at this residence 10 years ago. You know, sometimes these things go viral on social media. How do we respond to that, both, you know, the fact that it sometimes happens and the misinformation that goes around with it?
Yeah, look, those instances are very, very tiny. Often it's probably, it could be that a state is not part of, for instance, a cross state like an ERIC system where they're checking to see when people move around the country. A lot of times when I've seen this happen, states that don't have automated voter registration. So like when you go to the motor vehicle office and you update your address, if that process isn't automated, the election official won't receive that information that the voter has moved. So when we actually see those instances, I always ask the question of, well, what are the other policies in place that are in that state? When was the last time this voter engaged with the election office? When did they last provide that address? It's exceedingly rare that that happens. But usually it's related to another policy, not related to the actual process of requesting a mail ballot. It usually has to do with something else. And I, you know, I've seen mistakes like that. I've also seen where someone moves out, especially of an apartment complex or high mobility areas, and they've done that within 30 days of an election. Well, if a state has a 30-day cutoff for registration issues and they can no longer update addresses after that 30 days and a voter moves away, of course that ballot is going to arrive if the election official is prevented, which is the case in a lot of states with really long voter registration deadlines, if they're prevented from updating that record. And that's those are the instances we see. It's very rare, but those instances happen in very rare cases. But at the same time, even when that arrived to the wrong location, the other thing we haven't talked about yet, I talked about all the front end processing and steps and accountability and security measures that are in place. Then there's all the back end, including signature verification checks, the affidavit that gets signed by the voters. In some states, you have to provide either the last four of your social or your driver's license number, or even a copy of that, depending on what your voter registration status is. So there's a lot of verification that goes in on the back end. And so when you actually look at the whole process, mail ballots have far more steps of validation and accountability than other methods of voting that we see in the election process.
Yeah, and it demonstrates how the Postal Service process interacts so much with state law on these issues as well. Now, Amber, you've done so many things with respect to elections. You know, you were the director of elections in Denver. You ran the organization National Vote at Home Coalition, which advocates for expanded vote by mail policies. Now you're with the Postal Service. You wrote a book in 2020 titled When Women Vote that focuses on the stories of the struggles of women in particular that are faced in voting and the reform efforts to make voting easier for all. Given all of that and also the struggles of 2020 and the doom and gloom we hear about 2024, are you optimistic about voting in elections going into this election year?
So here's a few things. I started the nonprofit National Vote at Home. I haven't been there since 2021, so I just wanted to clarify that. But I've worked on all of these issues, whether it be technology and innovation, security and accessibility, expanding the franchise and access. One of the other very important issues to me is, and I've been an unaffiliated voter my whole career. Unaffiliated voters are now the biggest voting bloc. Independent voters are the biggest voting bloc in the country, and they're still largely left out of primaries. And I've been certainly working on a lot of those issues. I've worked across the spectrum on all nonpartisan related issues to really just to enfranchise voters to be able to use their voices and participate and engage, because I actually believe that the easier it is for voters to engage, obviously balancing security measures and accountability and all those things we have in place, but the easier it is for voters to engage and let their voices be heard, the higher trust they're going to have in the process, the higher trust they're going to have in the government that represents them. And so I think it's absolutely crucial that we ensure all voters can access the process. There's two things I would say about the 2024 cycle. First, I'm highly optimistic about the amazing election officials that are on the front lines of democracy. They have withstood attacks, threats to their lives, harassment, even systematic attacks, meaning they keep getting inundated with kind of bogus public records requests that are really just in an effort to distract them from doing their jobs. But these folks have been serving on the front lines. They've withstood incredible adversity with regards to this process. And they give me a ton of hope. And I hope everyone, you know, who's listening, I would encourage people to serve as a poll worker, sign up to be an election judge, call your county clerk or your registrar of voters, or your supervisor of elections. They're all called different things in different states, but call them and ask how you can help as a citizen. It could be getting the word out. It could be serving as an election judge. But these people give me incredible hope. And a lot of them are my dear friends, but they are on the front lines of our democracy and they're serving every day in the great face of a lot of adversity that's been thrown at them and often underfunded, I should say. The second group of people, I continue to be optimistic about the American voter. I have tremendous optimism for the voters of this country to make their voices heard, make choices that reflect the representation that they want to see in their government. And I would encourage all voters to continue to engage. I know it can be frustrating. I know it can feel overwhelming. I know it can feel frustrating to continue to see the sort of political fight always in DC without much happening. But I think it's so important that people continue to engage. And I have great optimism that voters will do that again. I will say that I am deeply concerned about, again, the impact on disinformation, the lack of knowledge generally in not only the public, but I would say actually a lot of the partisan politicians, when they talk about elections, they are often very wrong and they're telling people the wrong information. And so I continue to worry about the impact of bad information on voters, on the election itself. We're not sure how AI is going to impact things yet. We're not sure about some of the other security threats. So there's a number of really big concerns that I have about the election, but also great optimism about the people involved in it.
Well, I'm optimistic, you know, when we hear about the various checks that are within the system, the checks and balances you mentioned. So thank you for enlightening us with, you know, how mail-in balloting actually works. That's so useful for voters to hear. Amber McReynolds, thanks so much for joining us on Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, what would be your election law of the day?
Well, I'm going to have to talk about election laws because I want to discuss vote by mail and how widespread it is. You know, according to the National Vote at Home Institute, which is this organization that promotes expanded vote by mail opportunities, about 1/3 of all U.S. registered voters live in states or jurisdictions where they either automatically receive a ballot for every election or they had the option to do so via a permanent absentee voting policy. So in 1/3 of the states, and 8 states run their elections entirely vote by mail, and they run the gamut from so-called blue states like Oregon and Washington and California to middle-of-the-road states like Colorado to more red states like Utah. Arizona, most voters there are on a permanent absentee balloting list. So they automatically receive a ballot after they've opted in once. And I think there's a lot of promise for expanded vote by mail, as we discussed with Amber. So it's vote by mail in general and the expansion of it. Certainly the 2020 election and the pandemic caused a lot of states to temporarily increase the opportunity to vote by mail. The other interesting thing about this is that sometimes the policy is better known as a vote at home instead of vote by mail because it's actually ballot delivery through the mails, right? The Postal Service is delivering your ballot. But about half of voters actually drop their completed ballots off at a drop box instead of putting it back in the mail again. Where are you voting, though? You're voting at home. And that's why the National Vote at Home Institute prefers the term vote at home.
And I take it those states are seeing improvement in voter participation?
That's what's really interesting is if you look at the states with the highest turnout and you look at what policies they have, there's really two policies that are consistent. One is expanded vote by mail, you know, where states where you don't need an excuse to vote via the mails, where you either are on this permanent list, you only have to request once, or you're just on the list automatically. The second policy is same-day voter registration. About 2/3 of states have same-day voter registration where there's not a deadline before Election Day when you have to get on the voter rolls. And the combination of those two are really best practices in terms of improving voter turnout.
2024 certainly has our rapt attention. We're in a presidential election year, so a lot of conversation going on around that. And it's always fun to have a good nugget in your hip pocket to pull out when you're in one of those conversations. Can you give us a fun election fact?
So in talking to Amber about her book with respect to women's suffrage, I was curious, when have women run for office and run for president? And my research found that the first woman to run for president was in 1872, Victoria Claflin Woodhull. ran for president. She was a women's rights activist. She fought for women's suffrage. She was a popular public speaker and a newspaper publisher. She was also the first woman to directly address a congressional committee and the first woman to own a Wall Street investment firm. Alas, her campaign went nowhere, and she wasn't even constitutionally eligible to run for president or to become president because she was not yet 35 years old, which is the constitutional requirement. But Victoria Claflin Woodhull has the distinction of being the first woman to do a lot of things, including run for president in 1872.
You know, there's that saying, you never miss your water till your well runs dry. And same could be said for democracy. We take it for granted. It's like air in this country. It's part of how we've lived. Yet now we're hearing that it is seriously threatened. Some people say 2024 may be the most consequential year of their lives. What one thing can those of us who are concerned about that do to support democracy?
You know, Tom, there's a reason that we called this show Democracy Optimist, because I want to focus on tangible ways where we can sustain our democracy. And, you know, vote by mail is one, because it can make it so much easier for people to participate. I have faith in voters. I have faith that if we have, you know, closer to universal suffrage, then we can have a democracy that will be sustained. The problems are that we have all of these politicians and others trying to make it harder for a lot of people to vote. Universal vote by mail can break down, and it has effects on all voters, Democrat, Republican, or what have you. So I encourage listeners to visit the website for the National Vote at Home Coalition. It's www.voteathome.org, because they have really great facts. And we talk a lot about understanding what facts are and spreading truthful information. The National Vote at Home Coalition's website has studies, has facts about the power of voting via the mail, has facts about the lack of fraud with respect to vote at home. So one thing to do to support democracy, visit voteathome.org.
Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer, I'm the series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer, Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Email us at democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.